Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a discussion on human trafficking. The members of the panel will be Sister Rosalie Burke, a Notre Dame nun and coordinator of the Order's Social Justice Committee, and Stephen O'Mara, an assistant Nebraska Attorney General and the Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force Coordinator. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, May 12, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is our moderator, Ann Peterson, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Today we're going to be talking about a topic that's been in the news a lot, in fact even just this morning, on human trafficking and its impact in the Omaha area. More than 250,000 people are trafficked in the U.S. every year. With our location along I-80 and I-29 and regular hosting of major sporting events, thousands of these people flow through or into the Omaha metropolitan area. Surges in sex trafficking are commonly seen around major events like the College World Series, the Olympic swim trials, concerts, and conventions. Local anti-trafficking task forces have identified more than 100 cases of child sex trafficking in the area, but report that this number represents only a very small percentage of what's really going on in our community. Our panelists today are Sister Rosalie Burke and Stephen Patrick O'Meara. Sister Rosalie is a Notre Dame nun and coordinator of the Order's Social Justice Committee. She is chair of the Coalition on Sex Trafficking, which was started by the Leadership Conference for Women Religious. She's a former high school teacher, domestic violence volunteer coordinator, St. Vincent de Paul thrift store manager, parish minister, and pastoral planner and consultant. Stephen O'Meara, J.D., is a graduate of Creighton University Law School and has been practicing law for more than 43 years. O'Meara currently serves as an assistant Nebraska Attorney General, the Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force Coordinator, and the Child Protection Training Coordinator, authoring in October of 2015 the report and recommendations for the establishment of the Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force, which the Nebraska Attorney General adopted, establishing the NHTTF on October 20th, 2015. Sister Rosalie will begin, and then Stephen, and then we will open it up to questions.
Thank you, Ann. You heard her say that I was a teacher, and so teachers have some things that die slowly. You're going to have a pretest. No grades, but a pretest. I have four true-false questions for you. Most children and youth trafficked for sexual purposes in the United States are from foreign countries. True or false? False. Good for you. It is false. Victims are typically recruited between the ages of 12 and 14. True or false? True. Very young, 12 and 14. Human trafficking is the third largest criminal industry in the world. True or false? False. It's second. It is second only to drugs. It has bypassed guns. Viewing pornography often becomes addictive and leads to clients buying sex. True or false? True. Good, you did pretty well. I call my talk Human Trafficking 101. As we said, it's the second largest criminal industry in the world, with over $100 billion being taken in annually. These are human beings that we're dealing with, and the problem is that when you use guns and you sell it, it's gone. When you sell drugs, it's gone. When they have human beings, they sell them over and over and over again. More people are in slavery now than in any time in the history of the world. That sounds impossible for those of us who were in school and studied about the end of slavery, to think that we could have more people in slavery now. There are approximately 250,000 American youth at risk of commercial sex exploitation every year, and 90% of all children and youth trafficked for sexual purpose in the U.S. are citizens. Trafficking is defined as human sex trafficking, a commercial sex act induced by force, fraud, or coercion, or with anyone under 18. I'd like to read to you two stories of two kids who were freed that Stephen Patrick Gamera may tell you more about because he worked on the cases. But I think that just hearing statistics doesn't help us to understand the situation. So when I talk about trafficking, I always say, I wish you could leave here feeling really good, but you aren't going to. I hope you leave here feeling really bad and upset enough to want to do something about it. Katie was a 19-year-old female resident of Nebraska with a history of family and emotional issues. While living in a homeless shelter in Omaha, an acquaintance lured her away from the shelter and took her to a motel near a casino in Council Bluffs, where she was forced into prostitution. There, Katie saw other females being whipped with belts, burnt with cigarettes, strip searched for money from prostitution, and sexually abused by their main captor. Fortunately, within 3 days, Katie got out a phone call for help. When law enforcement arrived, they found her in the motel office, sitting on the floor, straddling a wastebasket into which she was vomiting uncontrollably from the trauma of her experience. Now, she was lucky. Some people are in for 5, 6, 7 years before they're freed. Jennifer was a 20-year-old female from Pennsylvania who was homeless and had a long history of psychiatric issues. She met a 25-year-old male who professed to love her and enticed her to leave her maternal home and go with him. She was forced to engage in prostitution in at least 14 states until being rescued in Omaha. Along with her was a 20-year-old single mother of a toddler who had also been kidnapped by the pimp. When found, the young woman was lying on the back seat of a car in a fetal position, crying uncontrollably out of fear of the pimp. You will see that the women involved are sometimes recruited and sometimes kidnapped. They're kidnapped from parks and playgrounds. There was a case of a girl visiting her grandmother in a small town. The girl was in a hurry to go to the playground. The grandmother said, "Wait for me." She went on ahead. When the grandmother came to try to find her, she couldn't find her. She asked the neighbors. The neighbors said, "Oh, we saw her get into a truck." She was not saved until 6 years later. They are recruited or kidnapped from homeless shelters, bus stations, schools, malls, foster care. If you're grandparents or parents, don't let your kids go to the malls by themselves. Frequently, if there's a group, the pimps know who to look for, who's vulnerable, and if there's somebody who's sort of a little behind the rest or not looking like they fit in, oh, they'll start flirting with them. They'll make an appointment to meet them at the mall at another time. They'll come back and talk with them, and they start promising them things if they find out what they're unhappy about. And how many kids, 12 to 14, aren't unhappy about something? So there's a lot of things they can be unhappy about. The victims are often people who have been poorly treated in foster care. They're runaways. They're throwaways by parents. It blows my mind, but some parents do kick their kids out. Some are homeless. Anyone who is on the street will be approached within 48 hours by a trafficker. That's the general rule. Trafficking happens less on streets and mostly on the internet, particularly on back pages. It's in hotels and motels, especially at large events. South Dakota, when there's pheasant hunting. truck stops on I-80 and I-29, abandoned houses. There's several cases in Lincoln with gangs doing prostitution in abandoned houses. Groups of men working away from home, particularly oil in North Dakota. Since oil isn't doing so well, they isn't happening as much. And people on their lunch hour, because guys can leave work, nobody knows what they're doing, their wife doesn't know. So who's vulnerable? Persons who have not been shown love, persons from broken homes, persons with low self-esteem, and that's something we really can do something about. We need to work with our girls to see that they have high self-esteem. Persons not included in the in crowd, persons who are very economically poor. They do a lot of recruiting of Native Americans on Indian reservations because that's some of the poorest people there are. Persons with mental, emotional, developmental disabilities, and persons suffering from addiction. And if they're not suffering from an addiction, they will frequently put them on drugs so that they can control them better because they've taken away all their money, their identification, and so they can't get drugs on their own. And so their pimp becomes a supplier of everything for them. So they're promised food and clothes and attention and friendship and love and a safe place to live and sometimes a job and freedom and opportunity for education. And, of course, they get none of those, but they're promised all that. What contributes to our problem? Pornography. People who watch a lot of pornography decide they want to try some of the things they've seen. Escort services, massage parlors. I always have to clarify that because we have a sister who does massage, and she says it's not all massage parlors. So there's internet and social media. One of the stories that just blows my mind is here in Omaha, a young child was checked out at 14 years of age by a pimp. She came down. The gal said, "Hello, Daddy." They're trained to call them Daddy. He took her to an appointment was allowed to do that. So schools need to do really good checking when they let kids out. What contributes to the problem? Culture of glorified sex, certainly sexualization of our children. One of the things I just cringe at are these where you have kindergarten and first grade kids who are in pageants. They got them in high heels and makeup. I mean, what are we doing to these kids? We're taking their youth away from them. We're taking their childhood. Pornography on the internet makes it really easy for people to get a hold of it without anybody knowing, and our programs on TV. The bottom line is if there was no demand, there would be no trafficking. And it'd be wonderful if we could say, no Baptists are clients. No Methodists are clients. No Catholics are clients. But we can't do that. Clients come from all economic levels, all professions, all ages, and all religions. We need assistance for victims, and we really need it in this area. We do not have any residents for that. 68% of victims meet the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. So these people have got the same kind of trauma as somebody who's been on the war front coming back because of the trauma they've gone through. They leave with nothing. They have physical problems from beating and rapes. They are likely to develop mental health problems, substance abuse, commit or be victimized by violent crimes later in life, depression, anxiety, codependency, and low self-esteem. And so they really need a lot of services. They really need at least a year to get a lot of support to be able to turn their lives around and to become the people that they were intended to be, that they have the gifts to be. If a person is not saved by the age of 27, they will usually die. They die from suicide, physical abuse, amount of sexual activity, or drug abuse. Shelters need to provide all kinds of things because we don't they need so many services. What's the face of a trafficker or a pimp look like? There's a wide range of criminal operators. There are individual pimps. Some are small families or businesses. One guy graduated from a school in West Omaha and was recruited by his uncle to go back and recruit senior girls from that school because he was a well-known athlete. And the money looks very inviting, but the respect for the dignity of the human person somehow gets lost in all this. There are some loose-knit criminal networks. There's some organized crime syndicates. There's local gangs. People, as I said, are motivated by quick, easy money. And they become in a stable. That's what the pimps call them. They have a stable of girls. And they've trained them to call them daddy. And they're forced to rely on their daddy for all sorts of things. Now, I used to always think that they had these girls and they moved from place to place. And they do. That's one setup. And so, like, they would go to major events from city to city. But there's more and more of them who are having these girls, and they have them so scared and so threatened that they stay at home and they see them and set up appointments. And that's even more scary. And you wonder what kind of pressure those kids must be under not to tell their parents for fear of what might happen to their parents. And the day-in, day-out pressure of all that. When you're dealing with a trafficker of a pimp, the dangers are very real. So when we teach people what to look for, we say, don't confront them. Report them. They've got a lot of money involved, and they're not going to just be real happy to have you doing anything to interfere with that. There's a national hotline, which is 888-3737-888. I suggest that everybody put that in their phone so that they can call it. If you see anything, you can report or call 911. Where can you help? You can pray. Being a religious woman, I totally believe in the power of prayer, and we need to do a lot in that line. But know your relatives, your friends, and your neighbors. If you think something is wrong in your gut, especially women, we do have that intuition. And if something you feel is wrong in your gut, it's probably wrong. Okay? Find out what's wrong. Teach children to respect all people. Boys to respect girls. Women, girls to demand respect. We really need to do that. And talk to your kids, your grandkids about slumber parties, about malls. And be sure they have a cell phone and assure them that you will pick them up at any time, anywhere. If they feel something's wrong, that you will come get them. You can visit notrafficking.org, which is on the little pamphlets we handed out. It's the website for the Coalition on Human Trafficking, notrafficking.org. You can invite someone to talk to a group you are in. You can become trained for a hotel motel staff, to train hotels and motel staffs. So I'll talk to you more about that in a minute. You can become a speaker and give presentations. You can donate money. You can educate your friends. You can support legislation. And you can incorporate intentions into your church service so you raise awareness so that you're praying when you're together. The coalition has five subcommittees. We do victim assistance. We're trying to figure out the best way to help people when they're saved. We do education and go out and give lots of talks. We work with legislation. And then we have a process where we are training hotels and motels, and our goal is within a 2-year period to train the staffs of all the hotels and motels within a 50-mile area of Omaha. And we have a fundraising because all this costs money. And, of course, we do the training for nothing. We just try to convince them they want to have the training. I think that the important thing is that until we realize it's happening, until we recognize that it's happening, until we report it, it's going to continue to happen because we can't change a situation if we have an unaware group of people. And I will turn it over to Stephen.
Good afternoon. My name is Stephen Patrick O'Meara, and as Ann said, I'm currently working with the Attorney General's Office for the State of Nebraska as the Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force Coordinator. Before that, I had a brief stint with a law firm here in town, but for 25 years before that, I was an Assistant United States Attorney in Nebraska and Iowa, and starting somewhere around the summer of 2007, I became engaged in that employment with regard to human trafficking, and really unanticipated when I came over and opened up the satellite office of the United States Attorney out of Des Moines in Council Bluffs, almost immediately began doing human trafficking cases. And that was with the establishment of the Omaha Child Exploitation Task Force in January of 2010. Which is a very active FBI-led task force involving a number of agencies that primarily serves Douglas and Sarpy counties in Iowa and Pottawatomie County in Nebraska. I was the main prosecutor for that task force for about 5 years and did the cases that Sister talked about. And I'm going to talk briefly as we go through this about four of the cases we did just for illustrative purposes as to what's going on. But I'm really going to kind of start where Sister left off, and that is the what can people do? And this message that we give out is varies a little bit according to who the audience is, but I will say that for most people, the things that they can really do is first, don't be a part of the problem. Don't engage with pornography. Don't be a buyer of sex acts. Don't consume products that you know are produced with forced labor. The second thing is probably awareness, which Sister addressed quite a bit, but that's really significant. The ultimate ability to impact the situation will depend upon the awareness of really the public in terms of influencing policy, legislation, and practice, and also being alert to circumstances that could be human trafficking. But most of us, unless we're in an identified area such as healthcare or the hospitality industry or transportation, really aren't going to see this as obviously as law enforcement or service providers should. So for most people, it's don't be a part of the problem. Be aware in general of what's going on in the community and influence to people to take the right actions with regard to that that are particularly in public service and the services industries. And then finally, enculturation, and I think Sister touched on this a little bit, but the reality is we pour a lot of money and people and programs into things like this, social evils, and if you go and research the statistics, I think you would probably find that adjusted for population, the numbers tend to get worse, not better, and that means we're missing something, and I'll just suggest to you that that's cultural change. In fact, I will tell you that one of the survivors we dealt with, in fact, it's one of the people that Sister talked about in her presentation, was at a presentation, a training we were doing at Project Harmony here in town with us, and she really kind of opted out of the presentation because, frankly, as you might imagine, it's kind of hard to stand up and talk to people you don't know about these things that happened to you. But she did agree to answer some questions afterward. And so as she was being questioned, one of the first questions that came from a group of primarily clinicians, social workers, people like that working through Project Harmony, she was asked, to what do you attribute what happened to you? She was the individual that was kidnapped out of a homeless shelter in South Omaha and taken and forced into sex trafficking at a motel near the casinos in Council Bluffs. And what she answered, and I'll preface this by saying, I've worked with this individual, I know her. I would describe her as kind of a free spirit. And so when she was asked the question, to what do you attribute what happened to you, I was very interested in the answer she was going to give. But she got really serious, and she said, the change in the values of the community. That was her answer as a victim and now survivor of this situation. So I think enculturation is something that even on the government side we push. We think one of the most important groups to have involved in this overall statewide project are faith communities, but also anyone of goodwill, particularly in groups that want to influence this and other associated social evils. I'll also say, since Sister said if your kids are going to slumber parties, have a cell phone, one of the things that parents absolutely should do is to monitor and control social media access by their children, particularly depending on the age of the child. That is the number one recruiting method for the bad guys with regard to sex trafficking to obtain their victims. Okay, so let's just look at what sex trafficking looks like. And Sister's kind of already covered it in general, but it's definitely slavery. Same thing with forced labor. It's slavery. Legally, under federal law, state law, internationally, it is slavery. A fairly credible report that I see quoted quite a bit with regard to sex trafficking indicates that up to 89% of the people we call prostitutes do not want to be doing this. They want out. Now, I don't know how legitimate that number really is, because we haven't done all these cases. And until we really get active, that is proactive, in doing these cases, we won't really know. But let's just presume for later statistics that that's a fairly valid statistic. Certainly, it's most of the victims, most of the people that the Omaha Child Exploitation Task Force encountered when I worked with them. And also, and we've discussed this among task force members, it's kind of hard to picture a young woman or a young boy who gets up some morning and decides, wow, I want to be a prostitute for the rest of my life. That really doesn't happen very often. So, in terms of the local market, a quick look would suggest, and we have some information from the Creighton University Human Trafficking Initiative, which is funded by the Women's Fund of Omaha. And by the way, the Women's Fund of Omaha is an absolutely incredible partner in what the Attorney General and the Salvation Army are doing to try to establish the Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force. But what this study showed us was that, among other things, from November of 2015 to March of 2016, so a very limited period of time, there were statistically identified 959 unique, that is, different people that were engaged in prostitution in Omaha. 959. Now, if that 89% figure has any validity, that means that there are, in that very short period of time, a few months, there were potentially 853 victims of sex trafficking in Omaha. That number actually would be significantly higher than I think we were thinking originally starting out, even on the basis of the experience of the Omaha Child Exploitation Task Force. Let's look at that task force very briefly. During the period of time that I was involved in the task force, there were approximately 250 primary and secondary victims of sex trafficking. A primary victim is someone who's actually forced to engage in commercial sex acts. A secondary victim is someone who's not actually forced to engage in a commercial sex act, but is closely allied to the situation. Of those 250 victims, of the primary victims, the range of age was 12 to 40 years of age. And I will tell you, because we concentrate mostly on minor victims, the minor victims make up somewhere around 47 to 54% of the victims of sex trafficking, which means we cannot ignore the adult victims either, because they're at least half of the victims that are involved. The average age during the period of time I was involved with the Omaha Task Force was 17 to 22 years of age. So it was young, but the pattern, the trend in the last 2 years has been, number one, there is a higher incidence of victimization, and number two, the age is trending downward, so that there are now more victims in the 14 to 17-year age range than there used to be. So all of those numbers are significant, but that gives you a couple of ways of starting to gauge how significant the problem is here. I will also tell you that there are certain things that tend to make up a sex trafficking market. And we're not talking a lot about labor trafficking, because honestly, we just don't know that much yet. Nowhere in the country do we know that much. The Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force is going to look at that too, and we're going to be proactive in that area also. But right now we're concentrating on sex trafficking. So if we're looking at what is happening with the sex trafficking, it looks like that the problem here is probably more significant. And if we look at those things that tend to make up a sex trafficking market, and I'm not going to go through them all in the interest of time, but I will tell you that Omaha is virtually a poster child. It's a checklist. It is a magnet. And it's also a source city for areas surrounding us in Nebraska and Iowa. Now, those numbers I gave you, which I think are fairly high, there was no special major event during that time period. And we also know that there is a spike in activity, that activity goes up during major events, such as Berkshire Hathaway, the College World Series, frankly, the swim trials coming up. Any of those kind of things create a spike in the market. But we also know when that happens in Omaha, there is a ripple effect that at least extends along Interstate 80 from the Quad Cities of Iowa and Illinois through to probably actually to Denver, Colorado, but at least to the Nebraska border. We also know that that spike, that ripple effect, runs up and down Interstate 29 as people travel to and from this area. We also know that that spike has a corresponding spike with regard to the victimization of minors. So we know all these things that we're learning. We have some anecdotal experience, but we're also beginning to learn now statistically because of the Creighton University project that we work very closely with through the Women's Fund of Omaha. Real quickly, I'm going to talk about four cases that we've done here, because this will give you a little bit more of a picture of what's going on. Sister's already mentioned three of them, but the first one is the Crane Horton case. This is the very first case that the task force did, the very first operation we ran under this. And I'm stressing, we will not make a dent in this problem until we run proactive operations. This is a hidden crime. We have to go after this crime, okay? But in that very first operation, we encountered a 19-year-old single mother who was homeless because her parents had kicked her out. She had a 9-week-old baby. And the way we encountered her was she was brought by two pimps from Omaha to an appointment in Council Bluffs. But interestingly, when the two pimps were taken down, in the backseat of the car in the middle of the night going to a prostitution appointment was the 9-week-old baby. And as it turned out, the way that they were controlling the 19-year-old single homeless mother was by threats against the baby. And then once the mother had been forced into prostitution, by additional threats that if you don't do what we tell you, we'll make sure you lose this child because now you are a prostitute. Sister Rosalie also referred to a person that I've dealt with, Ramon. Ramon was a good-looking, intelligent, not wise, intelligent, just graduated from high school, young guy who by all accounts was a really nice guy till his aunt and uncle got a hold of him and recruited him specifically to make him a pimp so he could go to high school and middle school events in the Omaha area. And in front of the parents and grandparents of high school and middle school children could recruit them into prostitution. And he did. And in that case, we were able to identify specifically a 13-year-old middle school and a 15-year-old who had been forced into commercial sex acts with adult males. The two adult males were also prosecuted in a collateral prosecution for sexual abuse of children under Nebraska state law. There are other things that are interesting about that case, but we'll just leave that at that. Another case that we did was the Case Buyer case. Case Buyer was a very successful athlete out of North Omaha who, on his way to the Philadelphia 76ers in the NBA, was injured, never had an NBA career, and turned to other things. And regrettably, while he was on supervised release to the federal court here in Omaha, which is like parole, but it isn't parole, he ran a sex trafficking operation. And in that operation, one of the victims was KD, the person that Sister described, who was homeless and kidnapped and so forth. But there were also other victims in that case. In that case, Case Buyer also distributed crack cocaine to the persons to whom he distributed victims for sex acts. He also established a business that would provide remote services. He would go as far away as Auburn and actually would go as far away as Hastings and Grand Island, both to recruit victims, some of whom, one for sure, he recruited out of strip clubs in Hastings and Grand Island, who was diagnosed and had a disability for mental illness. And so he established this remote operation, which is a step up in terms of the business plan from where the Crane Horton case was. Another case we did was the Bell case. The Bell case is a case of national significance. In the Bell case, a group of pimps operating out of Little Rock, Arkansas, ran a roughly half of the United States business for prostitution. We took evidence from at least 20 states running from New Jersey to Colorado and states north and south of that line. In that case, they recruited. One person was actually co-opted out of a psychiatric facility in Philadelphia. Another person was actually kidnapped out of a social event in Texarkana. Both of those victims were rescued here in Omaha. But the gist of this case is the large operation, kidnapping, again, the mental health component, and a very significant case. The last case that I want to talk about is the Cole case. In the Cole case, an adult male here in town routinely checked a 14-year-old out of a middle school in Omaha to take her to prostitution appointments in hotels and motels in the metro area. He also met a 16-year-old high school student a block from her high school and took her to appointments in the area. And that's just a sampling of the cases that we were engaged in, but it's an important sampling. So a lot of the gist of what we looked at is, you notice, most of these victims have identified vulnerabilities even before they're encountered in the system. We would suggest that those include, and they're somewhat summarized by what Sister said, but minors or individuals as adult who, as minors, either were abused or were in dysfunctional environments, mental and developmental disabilities, particularly issues with regard to judgment and intellect, addictions led by chemical substance addiction, but other addictions also, poverty, including particularly homelessness and educational deprivation, and other isolating factors, which we would look at generally, that would include things like language, cultural disparities such as honor or debt bondage, or fear of authorities, which would include fear of health professionals. And we always look to see who controls the means of identification and who controls the means of communication, because isolation is one of the keys to this working. Real quickly, in terms of consequences, and Sister kind of alluded to this, but there's a fairly authoritative study out of Chicago Loyola which tells us from a study of survivors of sex trafficking across the United States, 92% suffer serious physical injuries, usually from assaults. 92% suffer serious neurological damage. 98% suffer serious psychological damage, including 55% serious post-traumatic stress disorder and 42% at least one suicide attempt. 84% engage in substance abuse. And I will tell you that according to this study, and this is backed up again by the anecdotal experience of the local task force, marijuana is the drug of choice for pimps to give to their victims. And the reason is it medicates, but it does not disable. The person can still remain productive making money for the pimp. And at least 55% of the survivors reported at least one abortion. Now, we have a lot of work to do in Nebraska. The Omaha Child Exploitation Task Force does a good job, but it is very limited, even in the metro area, in what it can do. So we are strongly in the throes of trying to create a systematic response across the state, which is integrated. That is, it involves law enforcement, services, advocacy, and certain community partners. It is balanced because we have to look at the rights of the survivors slash victims. We have to, obviously, at some level, look at the rights of the defendant. But we have to look at the community, too, and what is necessary to help the community with regard to this significantly growing problem. And then it has to be proactive, which includes both outreach with regard to services, and that can literally be sidewalk outreach, but also much more effective screening and assessment with regard to the potential that a person has been victimized in human trafficking. And it really has to be proactive by law enforcement, because we are not going to get these cases by just sitting and waiting them to come to us. A survey that was done by the Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force, again with the assistance of the Women's Fund of Omaha, indicated some kind of startling things. And this was a statewide survey for which there were over 670 respondents. So this is a pretty good non-scientific survey. 33% said they felt they had seen a victim within the last year of the time surveyed. 70%, however, did not screen for human trafficking. 84% said they did not have the capacity to deliver services to victims of human trafficking. 78% did not track the victims to see what happened to them. And 75% said they needed significant additional training. So the Salvation Army, as part of this grant, is working out to reach on that part, on services. We are also. Law enforcement is trying to form a response where people other than the Omaha Child Exploitation Task Force are trained to work on this problem. With that in mind, on April 21st, the Attorney General sent a letter to all county attorneys, sheriffs, and chiefs of police in the state, asking them to identify a specific point of contact within their agency to deal with human trafficking. And on April 22nd, a multidisciplinary team put together by the Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force sent comprehensive two-day training to Washington, D.C. to be approved under this grant. But it would provide training for service providers, advocates, law enforcement, and other people engaged in this system. So we're really trying to get aggressive. There are a lot of other things that are happening, too. The Attorney General's office under the grant has just hired a full-time human trafficking investigator. The Salvation Army is hiring three services coordinators for human trafficking to be placed in the greater Omaha area, Grand Island, and North Platte. So a number of things are trying to happen to really step up what we are doing with regard to this. But none of this will ultimately be effective unless the people become aware of this, talk to their legislators, talk to their local service providers, talk to their local law enforcement, and make sure that this is something that we are all moving forward together on, because the numbers are getting worse and the victimization is getting worse. Thank you.
Want to open it up to questions now. So if anyone has any additional questions, please just raise your hand. There are pieces of paper and pencils on the table, and I'll come around and get it. I think the first question that I have is, what should we look for? What are telltale signs when we're in an airport or we're traveling on the interstate and we stop to get gas? How can we, just as civilians, individuals, identify something other than just intuition, although I think that's a good start. But what should we be looking for?
I'll start, and Stephen can add. I think if you're along the interstate, and particularly if you're at a truck stop, say you go in to eat, and if you see one man with five or six girls, and they seem to be going out and coming back in and going out and coming back in, they're probably out soliciting with the different truck drivers who are there. I think if you look at tattoos, and if they have any tattoo on them that says something that makes it look like they belong to somebody, because the pimps like to have them say something like that, or the worst thing around, a commodity, if they have a barcode on their arm, on their leg, sometimes under their lip, they put a barcode. Those are all signs. I think if you're looking at somebody who might be going to school, you know, are they, how have they changed? How are they different than what they used to be? Because anybody who's being trafficked for any length of time, you will see a change in their face, because you know how people look sort of starry-eyed, or when they get to the point where the only way they can survive is to go into themselves and quit connecting with others. Stephen, you can sure add to that, I'm sure.
None of these alone prove human trafficking. Even all of them together don't prove human trafficking. But there are things to be alert for. And again, I'll caution, I don't think being the civil patrol is the first calling for most of us as citizens. There are people that should be trained to do that. And to answer the question, we know, for example, from that credible national study I talked about, that 88% of the survivors of sex trafficking encounter a health professional during the term of their trafficking, and yet almost no healthcare providers screen or assess for human trafficking. Now, that's beginning to change, but you can see that there's a much higher likelihood that a healthcare professional is going to encounter signs of human trafficking than most of us out in the community are. We also know that approximately 74% of sex trafficking is carried out in hotels and motels, hence the Hotel Motel Project by the Coalition. And, oh, by the way, I'm also a member of the Coalition. In fact, I started with them before I started working with the Attorney General's office. So there are transportation is another one. Sister mentioned truck stops, but there's a very active national group called Truckers Against Trafficking. Nebraska was one of the last states to join that. But Nebraska now is actively engaged in that effort also. And then there's other things like the gambling industry. Certain facets of agriculture for us would be very important. But again, I mentioned faith communities in a positive vein. So to continue with some signs, I mentioned before control of IDs or control of cell phones, and sometimes that's very obvious who is controlling these things. Also signs of physical injury or deprivation. And particularly signs like substance abuse or alcohol abuse, malnutrition. I think I gave the statistic that approaching 75% of the survivors of sex trafficking had very serious dietary restrictions. In fact, malnutrition is not uncommon. And so there are sleep deprivation would be another really important sign. Sister mentioned the tattoos. Those are really big signs. The barcode, dollar signs, the name of the of a male, particularly if that name is preceded by the letter P or has the letter P following that name, P meaning pimp. You really have to understand this is almost a subcultural event. It's not in that sense just a business. Many pimps are actually very proud of what they are doing and advertise it. So, for example, in the Bell case I talked about, the really big case, the 20-state case, in that case, some of the victims had the name Victorious P tattooed on them. Victorious Pimp. Mr. Bell considered himself to be a very good pimp. So, Victorious P. I will also tell you that right after some training was done by the task force, an OBGYN doctor between here and Lincoln was in the emergency room doing an emergency delivery, noticed that the mother below her belly button had a barcode tattoo, noticed that the child was born addicted to controlled substances, and noticed that the father in the waiting room was acting anything but like an immediately expectant father. If you'll excuse me, my paraphrase of the attitude was reported is, how the heck soon can we get out of here and start making some money? That doctor, completely in compliance with HIPAA, reported that situation to the task force, and in fact, that turned out to be an active case of sex trafficking. But the best thing for most people to do is what Sister suggested previously. If it's an absolute emergency, you call 911. If it's not an emergency, you call 888-3737-888.
What efforts are taking place to educate businesses or chambers of commerce? Because I wouldn't think this would be terribly good for business, although maybe in the hospitality industry there it is. But what kinds of things are being done to educate businesses about this, to identify traffickers who might be in their business in a hotel or a motel or a restaurant?
Well, in the hotel and motel setup, we have this process where we have the mayor sending out a letter to the people who own hotels or motels, and then we have people who have been trained contacting them and then sending up a time for a 45-minute training session and then doing follow-up with them and just recognizing the change that happens in the people. What's so exciting to see is when you have somebody at the front desk or somebody who's a housekeeper saying, oh my goodness, I saw that. I thought something was funny. I didn't realize that's what was happening. And so they're learning and really working on that. As far as Chamber of Commerce and some of the other things, we've been working with them, particularly on trying to do something when we have major events in the city. It gets a little touchy. We try to do plaques that we put into hotels who've been through this training saying, we want to provide a safe place for you to stay. We've been through training. We can recognize and report trafficking. And so taking it very positively. But you have some people who are dragging their feet because it might hurt their business. It's also, we've been trying to deal with the powers that be, I won't name, but to have them get on board, and they don't want Omaha to be known as a place where trafficking happens. Well, it's happening in every large city. It's not that we're any different, so you don't want to just close your eyes and act like you don't see it. But then both Stephen and the coalition have set up and are in the process of setting up speakers bureaus to go out and talk to different groups like we're talking here so that they come to a greater awareness of what's happening in. And as we say, if we have an aware community, then something can happen. But we do have to change the culture.
That's a serious effort, too. I was at the Sunrise Kiwanis in Lincoln at 5:45 in the morning, so we take this pretty seriously. but service organizations, and Kiwanis has been one that has really been receptive. Rotary, particularly in other locations, in fact, both of those service organizations help fund efforts in different places with regard to particularly sex trafficking, but reaching out to other businesses too, so there is a concerted effort there. But part of the answer that we've been providing, and understand that the Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force and the Coalition on Human Trafficking work together quite a bit on these issues, which is what we want. We need to create that environment in order to better do the work of the task force, which is operational. But one of the messages that we have really been given, particularly to people like hospitality and so forth, the Visitors Bureau, people like that, look, awareness is rising. This is not exactly something you can, even if you wanted to, keep secret. People are beginning to understand that this is a serious problem, and it exists virtually everywhere. So if that's the situation, and you don't want it to damage the image. I mean, I think the College World Series, for example, is a phenomenal image for Omaha. If you don't want it to damage the image, get out in front of this issue. Be part of the solution. Don't be part of the problem. And I actually think that there is a warming to that approach, that the best thing to do is to get out in front. One real quick thing. The smallest population center I have seen a significant federal case done out of Iowa and Nebraska is Hills, Iowa. It involved a pimp and two teenage victims from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hills, Iowa is about 550 population. That should say something.
Sister Rosalie, Stephen O'Meara, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you so much. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a discussion on human trafficking. The members of the panel were Sister Rosalie Burke, a Notre Dame nun and coordinator of the Order's Social Justice Committee, and Stephen O'Meara, an assistant Nebraska Attorney General and the Nebraska Human Trafficking Task Force Coordinator. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, May 12, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be this Thursday, June 16th at 12 noon. At that time, the topic will be A Glimpse of Cleveland, a Crystal Ball for the Republican National Convention. The guest speaker will be Hal Dobb, former member of the United States House of Representatives from Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District, and former mayor of Omaha, who has attended 10 Republican National Conventions. Mr. Dobb currently serves as a member of the University of Nebraska Board of Regents. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.